You don't need a system outage to know when your PPE isn't delivering what it should. Maybe pricing takes an extra step to verify, maybe updates are taking longer than expected, maybe your team has built workarounds just to keep loans moving. What starts as a few small delays can gradually become the way the work gets done. The reality is, a modern PPE should do more than provide pricing. It should deliver real-time accuracy, seamless workflow execution, intelligent automation, and the confidence to act without hesitation. It should help your team move faster, operate more efficiently, and focus on performance, not process. So ask yourself, is your PPE helping your organization perform at its full potential, or is it forcing your team to work around its limitations? Take a closer look at what you should expect from a modern pricing engine. Visit optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Again, that's optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Stop accepting friction as part of the process. Make sure your PPE is helping your team move faster, execute smarter, and capture every opportunity.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us again this week. Deep into August now, starting to get into conference season, kind of back to school season. So I know everybody's busy, but appreciate you taking a little time out of your day to listen to the podcast. We've got a great show, as always. We're here making sure that you know what to watch out for, whether you're an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry, and some great market commentary. We'll kick it off here in a sec with a market update. And then we will get into an interview. We've got Todd Ledden from Leader One. He is a good friend of ours. We've worked together for a very long time. He's got some, you know, some good insights on what's going on in the industry. So we'll tap his brain a little bit to hear what he's been hearing out there and how he's been solving some of the issues that the lending world is dealing with today. He also wrote a book, by the way, called Protect the House, which you can find on Amazon. So we'll check that out. Just ask him a couple questions on the book, but generally just chat about what's going on in the industry right now, what we should all be paying attention to. Before we get to any of that, just in the way of data, you've likely seen some drama around the treasury rates, which we'll talk about in depth here in a moment. The 10-year right at 4.7 again, dropped a little below it last week on some interesting news, bounced back up to 4.7 today, down a little bit again, but still hovering around that 4.7 mark. And of course, the OBMMI, which is the 30-year conventional index, is about 2 points higher than that, which it typically is over the past year or so. So about 6.7. So let's get into it, gentlemen. What there was some news that I'd say got the market's attention last week. Some discussion with Scott Bessent, and there's been some discussion since then. But originally came out and said we're basically going to intervene in what we're seeing in long-term yields. We're going to double the amount of bonds that we're buying back on the long end of the curve. So think 10 to 30-year treasury bonds. And this is not the Fed, right? This is not QE. This is not the Fed. This is not central bank intervention. This is the U.S. Treasury buying long-dated treasuries in an effort to basically to manage the yield curve, right? They're trying to get long-term rates lower because long-term rates recently hit decades-long highs, right? About 20-year highs, which is a problem. But it's something that we've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast, the reasons why, right? It's not just U.S. borrowing. It's not just it's other nations borrowing to fund deficits and fund militaries. It's also all of the AI spending that's going on right now. You hear about Meta or Microsoft or Google borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars to fund data centers, AI buildouts, energy, all these things surrounding AI. And that's just this supply that needs to be taken down by investors. So investors are just demanding a higher rate for all of these long-term bonds. So I don't know, I'll stop there for a second and interested in what you two have on your minds regarding this potential, like the announcement was going from $2 billion to $4 billion in buybacks, which is a drop in the bucket, right? It's kind of like what we talk about with MBS buying and trying to manage yields on those instruments. But it could be a message that there's a longer term strategy here where the Treasury may actually have enough ammo to get something done by buying a ton of duration out of the market and either funding it with the cash account, like our tax dollars, or issuing short-term debt to fund those longer-term bonds. I don't know. What do you two think about what was announced and where we go from here?
I would say, over the past week, so since we recorded last, that it's definitely the big story. And I think the way rates reacted will tell you a lot about how drop in the bucket or not this is, right? So Bessent came out and he said, okay, we're going to double the buybacks. So we're trying to get the long-term yield under control. We're going to do that by issuing short year. So I kind of think of it as we're sacrificing a little bit of the 2-year in order to bring down the 10-year. And why do you do that? Well, 10-year is at the highest it's been since 2007. That's a headline that you hate to see, right? You just don't want that association at all. So it's good. And, it helps the American public to try and bring that down. But, immediately after the announcement, the 10-year did come down as everyone priced in this change. But come Friday, it had really bounced all the way back. I would say the 10-year had actually moved even worse. So the market was calling a little bit of, it's not big enough. It doesn't matter enough, calling the bluff. And I would say this morning, we're seeing Bessent is talking about how they can actually like tap into the general account that the Treasury has access to. And that's about $1 trillion worth of cash that they can spend. So not necessarily saying I'm going to do that, but it is trying to back up, set the message that, we're doubling it. If that's not enough, we are open to what we might need to do in the future. To me, it's signaling, it's posturing for how to try and resolve this.
Yeah, I think my thoughts are generally in line with James's. On the initial Treasury announcement, it said that they were increasing the buybacks from $2 billion to at least $4 billion. I clocked that at least portion there immediately. But it seemed that the market didn't really react to that until Bessent went on TV and really highlighted that, underlined it. And then this morning, it seems with the market action that we saw on Friday, giving back all those declines in the 10-year interest rate, that they're kind of putting out the story that, that they have ammunition, they're prepared to use it sitting there to bring down those rates. I think James nailed it on the head there that, they're interested in lowering long-term rates. That's no secret. And it would be ideal for them to get those rates down.
Good. Yeah, I guess it remains to be seen how this will go. It's a little bit experimental. It's been done in certain ways. I mean, the Fed has done this. The Fed has implemented what they used to call Operation Twist, right? Which was to, again, manage the yield curve by buying in one part of the curve and selling in another. I believe the Treasury's done something like this under Yellen, maybe not to this extent, but I guess we'll have to see what the size of these buybacks end up being and how it gets financed. We can't just continue spending cash, obviously, because that's, again, you run a deficit, you have to issue debt to finance it. But this administration has already favored the shorter end, right? It's favored T-bills versus T-bonds.
Yeah, Treasury had by a few single digit percentage points had increased the number of those shorter dated bonds that they were issuing in the 2-3 year range. And the way the market was interpreting that was they were waiting on longer term rates to decline. So this kind of seems like a doubling down of the bet, sell additional shorter dated ones, raise the rates on that. You're going to be paying a higher rate for 2 to 3 years with the hope that you can refinance into 10 and 30 years that are going to be lower. So in my mind, I do see that kind of as a doubling down there.
I've been thinking of it too as they're going to have to issue, 2 years in order to buy the 30 years. So more of those entering the market's going to push the price down, the rate of the 2-year up a little bit. And so it's almost, as it pushes that 2-year rate up, it's almost a little bit of a free rate hike, right? The Fed doesn't need to hike the 2-year rate if the Treasury just sells enough of these things that they move the rate inherently. So that does help with the inflation side. It also, the CME is not necessarily reflecting this, but in theory, it could give the Fed more time to pause and even eventually cut if the rate is pushed up for them.
Right. In essence, doing the heavy lifting for the Fed. Like, it seems like the focus has moved more and more away from what the Fed is going to do, which is exactly what the Fed wanted, what Kevin Warsh wanted. And now with this newfound idea that the Treasury may come in and actually stoke the flames of, you know, raising short-term yields, we already got kind of a quarter point hike out of that without the Fed funds rate having to move. All right. What else should we be looking at this week? We also get some inflation numbers, right?
Yeah. Coming back, last week was quite very quiet. We will get a PCE number this week. It'll be the only PCE number before the next Federal Reserve meeting, but we will get another round of CPI and PPI in September before the next meeting. That one's really expected in the range that we've come to expect of it, probably in the range of 3 to 3.25% or so. And then we have 3 weeks until the next Fed meeting, as I just kind of alluded to there. And right now it's still leaning towards a pause in any action on the federal funds rate.
And still seeing just inflation high. You know, if we are above 3%, that's the three handle. Seeing it in gas prices again, we've inched up a little bit, at least here in Colorado. I've seen it in a few of the other states I've visited. So not a ton of relief there. The war basically continues. Not a lot of solid developments there in terms of resolution. So obviously you're always going to want to watch that news for any sort of escalation or de-escalation. Today it feels like a bit of a de-escalation, but again, it's been Groundhog's Day with the situation in the Gulf.
Yeah, the U.S. is definitely leaning towards using economic pressure to coerce the Iranians to coming to the table. We are waiting on the quote-unquote economic D-Day that was promised last week out of the Trump administration. Bessent should be talking later today. So at the time that you're listening to this, listener, the specifics of that deal should already be out. The rumor mill is saying, I mean, you got to keep in mind that Iran's already under immense sanctions. So there's not a ton left in that chest. But from everything that I've read so far, it feels like they're going to really lean on secondary sanctions, which are already in place, but really hammer on these. Secondary sanctions being, if you are a business that interacts really with the Iranian economy in any way, whether you're an importer or exporter, if you do rial to any other currency exchange, anything like that, that you could fall afoul of U.S. sanctions and then get blacklisted economically by the U.S. So really, they're really just trying to choke off the Iranian economy through that. Things that we've definitely seen before, tools that have been in use for decades now.
Right, just doubling down on those or finding other areas where we haven't, you know, put our foot down on the Iranian throat, I suppose. All right, so we'll be looking out for news on that. Hopefully, like you said, when this podcast comes out in the morning, that'll already be done, announced, and hopefully in motion. So maybe there's, again, some sort of progress towards resolution of this thing. And then Jackson Hole is this week, right? Economic Symposium in Jackson Hole that happens every year. Kevin Warsh will be there. I'm sure people, even though he'd prefer we didn't, people will be, you know, trying to figure out what he's thinking.
Yep. Generally speaking, the Jackson Hole is a place for Fed chairs to kick around some ideas, maybe, you know, showcase mid-year any new ideas they're bringing to the table. We'll be lucky if we get that from Warsh. But yes, he will be speaking, as is kind of the place for Fed speakers at Jackson Hole. So keep an eye on that. That's later in the week.
Yeah, keep your eye on the comments from the Treasury. Certainly any comments that come out of the symposium in Jackson Hole, and then inflation numbers later on this week. All right, gentlemen. Thank you so much for the time and the insight. Talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. We've got a treat today. As promised, we have Todd Ledin from Leader One. He is EVP and Chief Capital Markets Officer over at Leader One. So he oversees all things capital markets and then margins and, you know, down the line, just all the things that we talk about on this podcast when we're talking capital markets. He's also been in the industry for a very long time, probably longer than he cares to admit. We're having him on today just to kind of have him drop some wisdom on us about what's going on in the industry and what we should be paying attention to. Thanks for being here, Todd.
Yeah, thanks, Jim and Alex. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys. I am a big fan of what you guys do over there in OB. So great opportunity.
Thanks, Todd. He's also an author, by the way. Towards the end of the pod, we'll talk a little bit about a book that he's written about capital markets, of which there are very few books, as everybody out there probably knows who's ever tried to go out there and get schooled on capital markets literature. But why don't we start with just general market conditions right now, Todd? A lot going on with rates, a lot going on in the industry, a lot going on politically, just some of the policy that surrounds our industry. I mean, what are you all paying attention to, and how are you generally dealing with market conditions right now?
Yeah, so it was an interesting start to 2026. I would say things were pretty positive, right?
It was so good. So good.
It was great. Volume was great. Things were cooking. And then, unfortunately, you know, we had to have a little bit of a conflict here with Iran. Basically, the 10-year in March just decided to go to another level, leg up on rates. And that created volatility for the second quarter. And it's interesting. You're hearing about, you know, also the new Fed chair came into play. And it was like, what's he going to do, right? How's he going to perform? Is he going to be the same as Jerome? Is he going to be his own being and, you know, run things differently? In the meantime, the market decided to, you know, drive upward. It's interesting. Today they talk about interest rate hikes, and I feel like the market's already there when it comes to how, you know, we're affected in the mortgage industry. And so that created some volatility in execution, which I've seen. You know, the specified pool values, which simply it's usually lower loan balance loans that, you know, they stick around longer. They usually have a pay up to them. And those values got compressed, and, you know, they don't trade exactly like a TBA. They're attached to them, and they have variation in value. That was tricky. It kind of, you know, the rug got pulled a little bit there. I also see, you know, servicing had some nice valuation at the beginning of the year, and it's come off a little bit. And then there's been some changes, I would say, with the agencies on their appetite. You know, they've decided to compete with the aggregators when it comes to our bids. And they actually, you know, they'll pay up on loans that they're after through the cash window. So that's been brand new, which has been interesting. But and I'm seeing it from both sides, Freddie and Fannie. So, and then I would say one other thing that has been pretty different when it comes to execution is Best Efforts has been actually winning a portion of our bids. So it's awesome that you guys have the ability at OB to look at all the rate sheets that we have. You know, you're like, really? Best Efforts is winning this, you know, 15%, whatever it might be. Each book's different, right? But that trend's been higher. So there's been a lot of volatility. I would say on the specified pool situation, if you get a lot of that production and that's in your footprint, you know, Edge, your guys' system, you guys created some duration specifically for those types of loans, and implementing those different durations, which is just simply a different way of trying to make sure that you have a negative correlation to your bond prices. I'm excited to give that a go and see what happens there. But being granular, I think, is a big thing.
Yeah, just diversity in your execution strategy, right? Like all the things you just said, we've had two distinct different markets this year, right? We had like a 5 handle on a 30-year fixed at the very beginning of the year. Things were great. Executions were strong. Spec payups, as you said, for things like low loan balance were very hot. And then everything turned upside down in the second quarter and third quarter, and likely to go into the end of the year. But in any kind of market, you don't know what's coming, right? We didn't know this war was going to happen. We don't know when it's going to end. We don't know what the next event is going to be. So just having diversity in your execution strategy is huge, because you never know when Best Efforts is going to stick out. You want to execute to that. The agencies are, the GSEs, as you said, are sticking out or trying to buy volume. So you want to be sure you have the ability to deliver to them directly and retain servicing, or to do things like co-issue. It's just whether you're talking about the COVID event or the great financial crisis or some of these small events in between, like taper tantrum and just events that have caused rates to go up or go down or to cause volume to spike or to crater. You need to have that diversity in your strategy.
Yeah, that is like such a big piece of capital markets. You know, a lot of demand of understanding capital markets seems to be outside of the actual strategy. They always think, oh, what's the newest hot product, the newest hot rate? And from my perspective, I'm like, do I have everything covered? That is like huge. Like in 2020, having your tickets with the agencies was a lifesaver.
And it was black and white between the successful companies and the non. So yeah, having the ability to retain at that time meant either you were able to actually make a few bucks on a loan or actually sell it for a loss if you were unable to deliver because there were so many, the aggregators were just over capacity.
Yeah, they're over capacity. They put way too much margin and you know, no MSR value, even negative to the TBA, I remember. And I'm like, whoa, we are lucky we have all these executions. And so you don't ever really know what the market's going to bring. And you need options and not derivative options. I'm talking options for execution. So
you're just talking diversity in general, right? And a system that can support that. As you said, you use Compass Edge. There's other fine you know, hedging software out there, but you have to have the ability to look at all of these executions, which there's, when you start to multiply them by the type of execution and then the investors behind them, there's literally could be thousands. There's at least many hundreds.
The matrix is huge. You know, we got like 27 investors and they have different executions. It's like some investors have five different ways of selling to them, you know, and you want to make sure that you have the ability to do that. And in your system, it's nice because you guys consolidate everything and, you know, you have a history of the data. That's key. Simplifying something that's very complex from the optionality. That's key in my opinion. And then, you know, when you're in my position, you're kind of like looking at the top and you're all trying to figure out why is this moving the way this is moving? And being able to zero in and target, okay, we need to change this, we need to change that. That is huge. And then having, you know, a team be able to work with you. Because I don't have all the answers. I just know when something doesn't look right, right? And then I have to go and go, hey, what do you guys think? And then I have to okay, I think we should probably do X, Y, and Z. I'm humble enough in this industry to know that you got to listen to opinions and on how to solve some of this stuff. And so I do really appreciate that piece of OB and the team that we work with.
Yeah, man. It's not always easy to get market intel from your neighbors. You know, they're going to be your neighbors, meaning your competitors in your MSAs. You're going to, you know, there's a little bit of standoffishness there typically, as you would think with any business. You don't want to
give away the market intel, you know? Right. And their advantage is just one angle, right? Where you guys see multiple angles. So having that view of multiple angles coming in, it helps you. It's just, you just need to simplify the data. So you can get something out of it and take action and then monitor. Did that work? That's going to be the exciting piece of the new, you know, edge durations on spec values. Hey, does it seem like it's working? And when you implement them for us, it didn't change the position that dramatically. It just like it fine tuned it.
Yeah. It's only 1-2% is what we're generally seeing.
Yeah.
When it comes to the spec durations, but you know, on a $100 million pipeline, that's additional 1 million in TBA, give or take. And that can be the difference between a, you know, a red or a black month.
Yeah. In this tight margin environment.
For sure. I mean, speaking of margins, like has this volatility this year presented a lot of challenges there, just how you manage margin on the front end to your loan officers and to your borrowers?
Well, we're pretty transparent model with our margins and we don't modify them a lot, basically at all. It's an interesting position from where I'm at, but you know, they have the ability on their side to adjust margins. And then you have margin management, right? They're just trying to, they're not necessarily looking at it from a depletion of margin and the total execution, the whole loan. They're looking at it from a competitive standpoint. So, you know, cost is a big thing to look at with margins. And this year, AI, I mean, you can't stop hearing about AI. Like, I think it's a tool that's going to be advantageous. I think the tool's going to evolve. And I think there's going to be tons of different ways to use it. So right now it's kind of hard. Like, it's like, you know, back in the day where there's a time period in culture, the Renaissance. It's like a Renaissance. That's the term I'm looking for. You know, just so much going on, like trying to figure that out. So I think from a margin position, you know, you want to stay competitive because the rates are where they are, right? And so adjusting a lot of front end, I mean, we pass through a lot of just the best efforts rate sheets that we get, and that's pretty transparent. So the key for me is, you know, we're always looking at costs of things and AI, how can that help? But on the back end, that's really where my control is on the margin, is basically making sure we sell to the highest bid and they purchase it fast, right? And they don't come back and do the smell test 1,000 times on you. Does this pass?
Yeah.
I think in the last 3 or 4 years I've taught anyone in this industry anything, it's, you know, control what you can. Because yeah, as you just alluded to there, Todd, you know, the rates are going to be where the rates are at. So, you know, yeah, control your margins, make sure you're not leaking dollars anywhere. Just control the things that you can. If I could ask, I think everyone in the industry right now is seeing where they can plug AI into their portion of the production process. Is there any one spot in the timeline of a loan that you've been like, wow, like AI is really gonna just really nailing this on the head?
I think, you know, that from an operational standpoint, there's going to be a big pickup there, whether it's underwriting or, you know, any of the day-to-day stuff that can be automated, any kind of data automation, that's key. In our world, you know, like looking at the position changing, you get an idea with AI, you guys, because most of the AI is being already implemented with your vendors on a lot of the technology. So I can't say that there's one place that just completely dominates, you know. I think it's a bunch of small, it's like an accumulation of little wins that in all sorts of different workflows. That's what I think it is. I don't think it's necessarily like, this is the magic bullet to make, you know, drop costs 20%. I think it's more like, all right, well, we got this process. Let's see how we can apply. And the other thing is you got to be pretty selective with folks that you talk to about AI, because they just come after you. Like, I get so many people on LinkedIn saying they can change the world and make, you know, make it sunshine and flowers and everything at your organization. And then you go talk to them and they're like, okay, well, this is the money that you're going to have to you put down. You're like, oh, okay, well, wow, this is supposed to be a net gain when it comes to costs. And so I still think a lot of that needs to be sorted out. And there's so much competition. So I couldn't give you a specific one single answer, Alex. I would say it's
okay,
just...
Yeah. No, that's a totally fair answer. And I think it's one that I've definitely read about myself, that maybe... I think those that are maybe keeping their expectations on AI a little more in check are saying in 5 to 10 years, it's just going to be another tool in the toolbox, which I think you were almost there saying, Todd, like,
that, you know, that's how I feel. I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're still humans and having to interact with technology, right? That relationship with technology hasn't changed. It's just different technology.
Yeah. It makes sense too, that there, like you said, there's not a magic bullet. It's we don't hear a lot of lenders that are implementing like single a la carte like AI solutions. It's the partners they're already working with, whether it's Optimal Blue or your LOS or your POS or anything along the assembly line of capital markets or creating a loan. you kind of expect at this point for your partners to be implementing AI tools within their technology, and you're either paying more for that or you're getting it for free or whatever it is, but you're not having to invest multiples into creating your own AI that could potentially be used by other lenders as well, right? So unless you really truly create something proprietary, it's expected that you're going to be able to get, you know, increasingly so, these AI tools from your partners.
Right. And I think that's where the big value pickup is, a lot of the vendors using it in their processes. I mean, I'll be looking for products and, you know, I'll use the basic ChatGPT sometimes when I can't find investors. I mean, like, I didn't have that tool before, right? That's, you know, you go to your network, and then if you just can't get anywhere, I'll ask the magic AI. But that's not like going to be a huge cost savings. You know, it's going to be like a time savings for me. And then I have to still continue to go down the rabbit hole and try to contact them and figure out if the story's real. And then you ask your network, what do you think about this? It just gives, lots of times AI to me gives you more questions to ask that are appropriate. Like, oh, I didn't think of that. But, you know, when it comes to workflow, automation is the king of AI. Like, that's what it fixed. So if you have something to automate, that's where I think you pick up.
Right. Practical application of AI versus some of these pie in the sky ideas that will come to fruition at some point. We're working on some of them ourselves. But the first thing we did was we attacked, like, what's repeatable? What is everybody spending time on every single day in their capital markets processes, whether it's reconciliation for gain loss or, you know, at a PPE, for instance, just going out and being able to more easily find the right product for a borrower when you're running scenarios, anything along those lines, right?
And that's not like game changing, but it sure helps, right? Those add up. Those tools add up. They get you to the end game quicker. So that's hard to compute.
Yeah. It's hard to add up a basis point
that you can measure, right? Mm-hmm. I bought here, I sold here. Like, it's
right.
It's like,
it starts to add up to FTEs at some point. Like, we've certainly done, or we've actually hired a third party to do some calculations. We did basically an ROI study that said, you know, went out and asked all of our clients, based on the tools that you use, what sort of time savings or dollar savings do you think that you've accumulated? And it ends up being, you know, over $1,000 a loan, which is significant when you've got loans that cost between, I don't know where you guys are, Todd, but $8,000 to $12,000 to produce. You know, $1,000 is double digit percentage, or over 1,000, it will be double digit percentage of what it costs. And that ultimately flows down to the borrower.
Yeah, because you can be more competitive with your pricing. And that's what the flow, that's what the natural flow, the waterfall is, to get the pricing even better for borrowers to bring them in. So I want to flip that question on, if you don't mind. What have you guys seen been the biggest pickup as a vendor with using AI?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything we've put out there has produced results on the desk, but also for our clients, whether it's, you know, something as simple, it's not simple. It's simple to understand, but it's difficult to create. We have a GL recon tool, for instance, that every single morning we know that every good capital markets person is out there spending time potentially in the morning explaining or digging into why their P&L has changed day over day or week over week. And we certainly do that on the desk when we see changes to a client's gain loss or a change to their position. And these gain loss recon assistants and the position assistant do that work for you. That would take potentially 30 minutes to a couple hours in the morning, depending on how deep you have to go. It does that work for you and sends an email out. It's also in the interface. Just kind of again, if you could shave an hour off of every day, you're talking 5 hours a week. That's significant. And then you have another
tool. I know that's been a big deal for a lot of other OB users. I love it. Like, you know, we look at it too. And so that has been huge for everybody else too, that you're saying.
Yeah. It's minutes and it turns into hours. And when we have either this organic growth that we're seeing now in the industry, where we're going to probably be double digit percentage over last year in terms of volume, hopefully continue to see that, or we have an event of some kind that causes volume to spike, you want to be able to encounter that volume and handle that volume without adding bodies like we always have in the past as an industry, right? So some of these tools and automation is what's going to get us to be able to do that without having these massive gyrations in headcount.
Yeah, I think in the capital markets area, we can be pretty lean these days. It's, you know, with your automatic locks and all that technology, yes. It's been fantastic. Like, you know, if we doubled our business, maybe we'd be another lock person, but it's like, other than that, all these tools have been helpful for that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Auto lock's a huge one. That's not even AI. It's just automation, right? Which kind of go hand in hand, but just allowing your lock desk to sort of run itself. And then when you do have a question, you can ask OB. That's another little bit of a plug there, which is a feature where you can say, you don't necessarily need an analyst to go out and chop up data for you or find what your volume was in, you know, July. You can just ask OB, what was our volume in July?
AI is kind of like just an analyst, right? And you just, you know, hey, can you get me this, you know?
Right. Ask a simple question in English and get, or I guess any language really, but plain words and get an answer.
And they don't get annoyed with you, right? If you ask it multiple times.
That's right. You just asked me this last week, Todd.
Yeah, they're like, dude, come on, Todd. Come on. No, the AI doesn't do that. Oh, well, that's a great idea. Let's look at this.
Yes. It's sometimes almost too accommodating and too cheesy, but it gets
the job. Yeah, and you're like, whoa, you're being a little too nice to me here, buddy.
Man. All right. Well, yeah, AI certainly is a revolution, or it's a renaissance, as you said. You know, many have compared it to the Industrial Revolution, or at the very least, the internet kind of proliferation throughout the world that happened.
Yeah, it's really like an extension of the internet, right? Like, we just, ever since the internet was, you know, created, all this different stuff technologically has been building on top of it.
It's a steep curve, and it just keeps getting steeper. So it will be very interesting to see where we go from here.
Yeah, definitely eye-opening. And you got to learn a lot, you know?
Yes. Well, I think we're all still learning. Like you said, some of us are just using ChatGPT on our phones or Copilot at work or using features of products we already use. But it's hard to be in front of the ball. Like, I feel like we're all chasing it at this point. There will be a time when the human brain probably can't keep up with the innovation that's happening. And that's really where people's brains start to bend a little bit when they think about what the future looks like, and, you know, utopian versus dystopian.
Anyway. Yeah. And whether you're a positive person or a negative person, you take it to conspiracy places, or you take it to utopia and nirvana, and like, it's everything's amazing.
Terminator 2. Yeah.
Or Terminator 2. What you're into. Yeah. And nothing's changed about, you know, good versus evil AI, you know?
Agreed. All right, Todd. Well, before we sign off, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your book. We've all either read it or at least skimmed it, and we kind of, you know, we understand the content generally speaking, but you've definitely put it together in a way that I feel like is approachable by anybody, whether you're in our industry or not. If you're just interested in how capital markets works and where a mortgage comes from and, you know, how you protect interest rate risk and all this sort of thing. What's your plug for the book, Protect the House?
Yeah. So I appreciate you mentioning that. And whenever I was first starting out in this industry, it was really hard to get like the full scope of the whole, it's circular, right? Everything's circular. And I would sit in, you know, pricing or something, and just one section of the whole book. And everybody always seemed to be, it was like mystical when it came to capital markets, right? It's like behind the curtain kind of thing. And really, it's just a discipline. We just, in, you know, the capital markets is just a way for us to have money to fund loans. And a big portion of capital markets is making sure that you don't lose margin, because it's a financial instrument. Financial instruments move so fast, right? When it comes, you know, if you're making a pair of shoes, I don't know if the goods that, you know, the products that create the shoes move as quickly as something like a financial instrument. And so I just thought about me as a young person coming into the industry. How would I have wanted to understand this? And so I was very like methodical on the different, you know, areas and chapters. But I also wanted to, you know, have a professional capital markets person potentially look at it and go, Yeah, he summarized that up quite right. And that's what we are kind of trying to do. And there's a section in there with like margin management. That is like the most complex part of when it comes to capital markets and managing margins. Like to me, it's part art form, it's part testing. And gosh, the markets move around so fast. You think you have it and then you don't. So I just wanted to create framework, like a handbook where you could read a portion of the book, set it down, and then go, oh yeah, let me just freshen up on that. And so that's why I put together, because I felt like a lot of, you know, very important people in the mortgage process didn't quite understand it the way they could understand it. Because to me, it's a discipline. It's not something that you can't understand without putting a little bit of effort into it. Like, I kind of want to know excuses, right, from people to go, oh, I don't understand hedging. I want to be like, all you're trying to do is offset the movement of the loan. So whatever you thought you're going to make on it, you're going to make. So that's kind of how I wrote it. Then I was lucky to work with a guy who was kind of like reading the book behind me as I was writing it. And he was a real estate broker. So he's like, oh, this is interesting. He's like, oh, that doesn't make any sense, Todd. You have to rewrite that. So it was nice to have that structure behind it. And he helped me with, like, I never would have thought of this, but adding definitions in the beginning of the book, each chapter. Like, so you don't have to keep, because what I was doing is I was talking about something and then I'm like, oh, are they going to understand what that is? And then I would define it in the story. And then you'd go off defining something and then you'd be like, oh, I had to get back to the thing that I was actually going to be talking about, the concept I was going to talk about. That's why it's kind of handbook-like. And I do, you're right, I do. I start off like, hey, America's innovative, man. We created a capital markets for the mortgage industry. This is how it started. So,
right. And it's like no other country in the world too. So it's yeah, even smaller universe. Like you have a very unique instrument and product and ecosystem. And then in our part of the world, capital markets, there's very few of us. There's very few college courses on this. And if you're lucky, maybe you get a day or two in class to talk about mortgage-backed securities, and you're likely not going to get too much into hedging.
They just talk about it from a bond cash flow perspective.
Yeah.
That's all they're talking about is how bonds work.
From the investment side versus actually where do the loans come from? How are they produced? Right. So we certainly have, we have a few copies of your book on the desk, just kind of floating around, and we have newer people especially read it. Cause as you said, there's very few books on this subject. There's a couple, but they're starting to get fairly old. Yours is relatively new, and it does, I like the structure, how it does generally simplify each of these topics. It's got a little bit of a glossary at the beginning of each chapter that explains what certain words mean. So like you said, you don't have to go back and explain yourself as you're explaining the process or the flow or the concept that you're trying to convey. Yeah, I think I think it should be required reading for folks entering our world, but also just trying to get a refresher on what it's all about, or whether you're overseeing capital markets people, you're becoming one, or you've been one, and you just really want to gain intel from outside of your own organization.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's a little bit different is because I have been in this position, I know that building relationships is huge on your success, but that is not interest rate driven, right? So I wanted to put a humanity component inside there because I'm a human doing it, right? And so it's important to build relationships. Like I've known you guys for a while and like you're huge to our success. So yeah, I appreciate it. And I think that you're viewing it how I tried to, you know, write it. So I'm glad to hear that feedback. Humbly. Yeah.
I think it's a great reading for someone in the first 1 to 3 years probably in the mortgage industry. Or I think it's also great, and I'm sure both of you would agree, for friends, family, and significant others who are like, what do you do? What do you do all day? And you've explained it 10 times, but maybe putting it on paper might help them as well.
And then if they're having a problem sleeping, insomnia, they can use it for that too at night. So.
Yes. Well, totally agree. I appreciate you saying that about us too, Todd. And again, love the book. Would recommend it to everybody we just talked about, which is pretty much anybody out there who's curious about capital markets or wants to brush up or wants to know what their significant other does for a living in our small corner of the world.
I feel like my wife still doesn't know.
That's the same. Same. I've been doing it for too long, and my wife still doesn't know exactly what I do. Nobody really does unless they're sitting in the room with us in Denver, DC, or San Francisco. But yeah, thank you so much for doing this, Todd. This has been an awesome conversation. Todd Ledin, Leader One. The book is called Protect the House. You can get it. I believe you can get it on Amazon or wherever, right? Like it's
Amazon. Yeah.
It's out there. Yeah. Amazon is, I think, I don't know where you even buy books anymore. There it is.
Yep.
Looking good. Swords and shield, protecting the house.
Protecting it, man.
Right on.
All right, Jim and Alex, I appreciate it as well. Great chit chat, man. Let's
thanks, Todd. Let's do it again
protect
sometime.
Our houses. You guys got to protect house. Multiple houses. I just have to protect one.
That's true. We protect 300 houses every single day. There and, you go. yours is one of them.
Yep.
All right, Todd. Thanks again, sir. Thanks, Alex. We should do this again soon.
Yeah.
Take care, guys.
Take care. Todd. Bye.
And that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.